Imagine for a second that you work in an environment where a harmless joke by the water cooler isn't just an HR violation.
Right, it's something way bigger.
Exactly. Imagine a workplace where that joke is actually a potential matter of life and death. You know, a threat to public trust and a literal risk to the constitutional rights of the citizens you serve.
Because in most jobs, I mean, a bad joke just reveals poor character, right?
Right.
But in law enforcement, it carries this massive operational weight.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're getting into today. Welcome to the deep dive, by the way. Our goal for you today is to provide some really actionable advice for police leaders, supervisors, and, well, officers on how to improve organizational culture and fairness.
Which is so critical right now.
It really is. So we are looking at a 2026 article by Eric Sanders. It's titled "Not Harmless: What Just Joking Reveals About Bias, Discretion, and Fair Policing."
Right. And Sanders extensively analyzes this major 2025 behavioral science study. It was done by Yale scholars John F. Davidio and Philip Atiba Solomon.
So we're going to unpack the behavioral science behind why just joking is actually this giant operational warning sign, and how leaders can build a culture of true procedural justice.
But for you listening, we really need to set the parameters of this analysis right up front. I mean, this isn't a conversation about labeling officers as, good or bad apples.
Right, the whole bad apple thing.
Yeah, that narrative is something this research actually heavily pushes back against. Instead, we're taking a very objective look at how human perception, cognitive demand, and organizational culture all kind of intersect.
Especially in those high stakes, highly discretionary environments.
Exactly. We are examining how the human brain works under extreme stress and how the culture of a department literally programs that brain long before a 911 call ever drops.
Okay, so let's start with what is actually happening in an officer's brain when a so-called harmless joke is told in the locker room. Because the Sanders article goes really deep into the science of perception here.
It does. And he argues that stereotypes don't just change our opinions, they literally, physically alter the way we see the world.
Which sounds crazy, right? But the Yale study, the one by Davidio and Solomon, brings some really heavy empirical evidence to back this up.
Yeah, they approach implicit bias not as some moral failing, but as a biological cognitive shortcut. And they detail these shoot or don't shoot simulations to actually measure it.
So how do those simulations work exactly?
Well, basically, participants are seated in front of a screen and images flash for just fractions of a second. A person appears holding an object.
And it's either a weapon or something harmless.
Right. Sometimes it's a wallet or a cell phone, and sometimes it's a firearm. And the participant has to make this split-second decision to press a button to shoot or not shoot.
And the data there reveals a pretty severe disparity based on the race of the person on the screen, doesn't it?
It's a huge disparity. The data consistently shows that participants mistakenly shoot unarmed black men at higher rates than unarmed white men. And they react much more quickly to armed black men.
Wow. But the Yale study takes it even further into actual visual processing, right?
Yeah, they found that after participants are primed with images of black faces, they identify crime-related objects far more quickly.
Just from seeing a face first.
Exactly. And crucially, they are significantly more likely to misidentify harmless objects,
Okay.
like a tool or a phone. They misidentify them as weapons.
Wait, let's make sure you, the listener, really grasps this, because we aren't just talking about a gut feeling here or just a prejudice.
No, we are saying the physical mechanics of human vision actually change.
Right. The stereotype isn't just a thought, it's like a physical filter on human eyesight.
The visual cortex is literally processing the environment differently based on that cognitive priming. And this is where the language and the quote-unquote jokes in a squad room become so critical.
Sanders highlights the extreme danger of dehumanizing language, doesn't he?
He does. The article cites some pretty intense anecdotal evidence and actual police text messages where officers use terms like girl is in the mist or NHI.
NHI, meaning no humans involved,
Right.
right? Which they use to describe black citizens.
Yes. And the behavioral science demonstrates that associating black people with apes actually alters visual perception in real time.
It directs the brain's attention toward threat.
Exactly. And it significantly lowers the mental barrier that ordinarily restrains physical force.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. We shouldn't view these jokes as just venting or like blowing off steam. It's like treating a joke as a check engine light on a dashboard.
That's a perfect analogy.
Because the joke isn't the traffic stop and the meme isn't the use of force, but it reveals the cognitive software running in the background. It tells you the software is corrupted.
And you have to remember that under dynamic, high-stress encounters, officers are dealing with severe cognitive demand. I mean, they are facing extreme time pressure.
And what researchers call crime salience, right?
Right, crime salience, meaning a heightened expectation of danger based on the specific call they're responding to. Plus, they often have extreme fatigue. The research notes that officers show much stronger implicit racial bias after nights with less sleep.
Which makes sense. You put a human brain in those conditions and its working memory is just tapped out.
Totally tapped out. It cannot process every single variable in real time, so it has to rely on those cognitive shortcuts we talked about.
So split-second decisions do not eliminate bias. They magnify it.
Yes, they magnify it. That's why Sanders argues that leaders absolutely must treat dehumanizing humor as a direct indicator of defective professional performance.
So if those cognitive shortcuts are running wild under pressure, we really have to look at who programs those shortcuts in the first place, because individual brains don't operate in a vacuum.
No, they operate inside a department.
Right. And the group dynamics of the squad room are what actually amplify these biases.
Researchers call this the meso level of organizational influence. Basically, when we evaluate the moral weather of a police department.
Oh, I like that term, moral weather.
It's great, right? We shouldn't look at the formal mission statement that's framed in the lobby. The moral weather is set at the meso level. The unit, the platoon, the night shift, the specialized gang task force.
It's set in the locker room and on the text chains.
Exactly. I mean, a department might be filled with individuals who consider themselves completely egalitarian, but if the local unit culture rewards aggressive, biased behavior, that meso-level culture will govern the street.
And the newer officers coming in are the most vulnerable to this, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. They're looking around, trying to figure out how to survive and just fit in with the veteran cops.
What does the data say about those younger officers?
Well, what's fascinating here is the data reveals that younger, inexperienced officers are inherently more likely to use force, and they're more likely to rely on limited visual cues like race.
Just because they lack the operational experience to read a chaotic scene with any nuance.
Exactly. So when a rookie enters a unit, the experienced officers dictate the norms. They're the ones who decide what gets last off and what becomes career suicide to challenge.
So if the veterans are sharing dehumanizing memes, the rookie learns that, hey, this is the acceptable way to view the public.
Right. Veteran officers play a critical role in setting inclusive standards, because without them, younger officers have almost no ability to resist the pressure to participate in that group humor.
Which naturally brings up this massive debate in policing between the warrior and the guardian mentality.
Right, the warrior prototype.
Yeah, which valorizes this gun-centric, aggressive masculinity where the world is viewed as intensely hostile. But wait, let me push back here on behalf of a police leader listening to this.
Sure, go ahead.
Don't officers need a warrior mindset to survive a genuinely dangerous job? I mean, they are out there facing real lethal threats. How does a leader shift away from a warrior mindset without making their officers feel unsafe or unprepared?
That's the classic question. But the behavioral science clarifies that shifting away from the warrior mindset is not about ignoring real danger. It is about addressing threat inflation.
Threat inflation. Okay, explain that.
The warrior culture, when taken to its extreme, teaches officers to see the public entirely as an enemy, and often in highly racialized ways. The problem is when the culture trains an officer to perceive a lethal threat from the very initiation of a routine encounter.
Right, leading to a forceful response before the circumstances even warrant it.
Exactly. It actually makes the officer less safe because it escalates situations unnecessarily.
So branding a department as guardians without actually changing the locker room culture is like updating the user interface on an app but leaving the malware running in the background code.
That is a great way to put it. You can put up all the posters you want about community guardianship, but if the guy who talks tough and makes the dark jokes gets the promotions, the formal messaging completely fails.
So if the warrior mindset is creating threat inflation, a leader can't just mandate nicer behavior. They have to change the incentive structure. Which brings us to what the article calls the inside-out solution.
Right. The inside-out logic focuses on internal procedural justice.
Okay, break that down for us. What does internal procedural justice actually look like?
It means officers perceive their own department as procedurally fair, meaning The internal rules apply equally to everyone. Discipline is transparent and just, and their voices are actually heard by leadership.
And when they feel that way, they trust their supervisors more.
Yes, they trust leadership, they experience better personal well-being, and critically, they are far more likely to endorse democratic, fair policing on the street.
So internal fairness creates external fairness. For police leaders listening, the actionable advice here is that cracking down on racialized joking isn't about being, you know, overly sensitive or politically correct.
Not at all.
Yeah.
It's a core issue of organizational justice. A fair internal culture makes officers less likely to adhere to the notorious code of silence.
And it makes them less likely to justify noble cause corruption, too.
Yes, exactly.
And for anyone listening who might be unfamiliar, noble cause corruption is when an officer breaks the rules for what they believe is a quote unquote good outcome.
Right. Think of an officer who plants evidence on a known drug dealer because they, quote unquote, know the guy is guilty.
They violate the Constitution to get a noble result.
Exactly. And when a supervisor lets the joke slide in the squad room, they erode the procedural justice of the whole department. But addressing them builds the foundation for officers to actually intervene with each other.
Okay, but let's be real about peer intervention for a second. Cops are notoriously protective of their own. Is a two-hour workshop on intervention really going to make a 22-year-old rookie tell a 20-year veteran to back off during an arrest?
That's the hurdle, right. And the Sanders article points to the tragic reality of bystander non-intervention, specifically citing the murder of George Floyd, while other officers just stood by.
Yeah, that's the ultimate example of this failing.
The science shows that people drastically overestimate their willingness to intervene. We all like to think we'd step in and stop a colleague from doing something wrong. But under pressure, surrounded by unit culture and hierarchy, people freeze.
So what's the actionable advice then?
Leaders need to implement peer intervention training to give officers the actual tactical skills to address problematic behavior in real time.
But training alone won't overcome that hierarchy you just mentioned, will it?
No. Training alone completely fails without macro-level policy interventions. You need frameworks like the Department of Justice's affirmative duty to intervene codified right into the department's DNA.
Meaning if the policy doesn't explicitly protect the officer who steps in?
And severely punish the retaliation against them.
Right. If that's not there, the train is useless.
It has to be formally required and culturally supported for an officer to say, hey, that joke isn't okay, or to physically step in and say, step back. You're too hot right now.
Wow. Okay, so having established how unit culture drives individual perception, we have to look at why this internal procedural fairness and peer intervention matters so much to the general public.
Because it directly links to the core mission of law enforcement, which is community cooperation.
Right. If the internal culture is broken, the external mission fails. Let's look at how a compromised internal culture plays out on, say, a routine traffic stop.
Okay, so DeVideo and Solomon reviewed body-worn camera research showing that officers speak with less respect and use a more negative tone to Black community members during routine stops compared to white community members.
Which creates this vicious cycle of stereotype threat.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, imagine a citizen gets pulled over. The officer, whose biased frame has been rehearsed through locker room jokes, approaches the window with a sharp, suspicious tone.
Let's pause and look at why that tone affects the citizen so deeply. Why does a nervous citizen lose verbal fluidity?
It comes down to cognitive load. The citizen's brain is suddenly trying to manage a perceived threat. They're analyzing the officer's tone, worrying about their own safety, and trying to figure out how to de-escalate the person with the gun.
That consumes a ton of working memory.
A massive amount. And because their brain is working overtime on survival, they become less verbally fluid. They might stammer, hesitate, or engage in self-regulatory behaviors.
Like looking away or fidgeting.
Right. Just to try and calm themselves down.
And why is the officer biologically primed to misread that hesitation?
Because the officer's threat assessment is being filtered through those cognitive shortcuts we discussed earlier. The officer misreads the citizen's anxiety, which, by the way, the officer's own harsh tone helped create.
Right. The officer caused it.
And they misread that as evasiveness or deception. The officer is primed to see the stereotype, and the interaction practically guarantees they will find evidence to confirm it.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It is. And this leads to staggering disparities. Body camera analysis shows that Black people are 63% more likely to experience force in a police encounter than white people.
63%.
Yes. And crucially, That force happens much earlier in the encounter.
So what does this all mean? It means the department's culture isn't just a PR issue. This isn't about, you know, avoiding a viral video or a lawsuit.
No, it is absolute mission damage. Sandra's details how invasive or unjust police contact shaped by racialized perception forces communities to develop what sociologists call collective autonomy.
In plain English, that basically means the neighborhood decides they'd rather handle a burglary or a dispute themselves than invite a hostile occupying force into their homes.
Exactly. They distance themselves from public institutions entirely. It statistically suppresses citizen crime reporting and 911 calls, particularly in Black and Latin neighborhoods.
So for a police leader listening to this, your core operational capacity depends on intelligence, right? On witness cooperation and victims coming forward.
Yes. A culture that tolerates contemptuous jokes literally destroys your ability to solve crimes.
So the actionable advice for leaders is to create clear, consistent policies that explicitly link professional language to better community cooperation. Alienating the public is quite literally a loss of operational capacity.
You can't do your job if the community won't talk to you.
Exactly. Okay, we've tracked this from the start. We move from the hard neuroscience of how stereotypes physically alter a person's visual processing and threat assessment to how the squad room culture normalizes those biases for rookies.
Right, the meso level.
Yeah. And then we looked at the actionable steps. Implementing real peer intervention backed by policy, shifting from a toxic warrior mindset toward a guardian identity by changing the incentive structure. And finally, using internal procedural justice to build external community trust.
The overarching lesson for law enforcement leadership is that you cannot compartmentalize this behavior. Problematic speech, dehumanizing humor, racialized memes, they all must be treated the exact same way a department treats a negligent firearm discharge.
Or a culture of reckless driving.
Exactly. As an early warning sign of impaired operational judgment, this raises an important question for leaders. What is your department teaching officers to admire, and what forms of contempt are being treated as harmless?
Whatever you tolerate in the locker room is the exact standard you are establishing for the street.
It's a check engine light, and ignoring it guarantees a breakdown.
Well said. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. But before you go, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over. Something building on everything we just discussed.
Ooh, this is a good one.
We know that human biases and squat room jokes shape the historical data law enforcement collects. Like, who gets stopped, who gets written up, and who gets categorized as a gang member based on an officer's discretionary threat assessment.
Right, the data reflects the bias.
Exactly. Mm. So what happens when that same historical bias data is fed into the new AI predictive policing algorithms being rolled out today? Are we just mathematically coding those harmless jokes into the permanent automated future of law enforcement?
That is a terrifying thought.
Think about that workplace we imagined at the beginning. The life and death stakes just got an algorithm. We'll see you next time.